Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue our international global perspective. And what we want to do is look at three new governments. And these three governments about to introduce even more austerity for the rest of us. Yes, even more austerity. And that includes the U.S. I want to look at the U.S. Congress and its recent Omnibus Act. I want to look at the Ukraine government, the U.S. IMF / Ukraine government that is accelerating austerity. And then I want to look at Japan's new government, just elected here at early December. All these developments occur early December to line up for the 2015 year. I began talking about Japan very quickly at the end of the last show, but I didn't allocate my time very efficiently, and we got cut off appropriately since I wasn't watching what was happening. So we want to talk about Japan, too. So we got three governments, U.S., IMF Ukraine, and Japan. And in all cases, what we have is the beginning of even more austerity measures for the coming year. All right, let's look at the U.S. first. And the focus is this so-called omnibus bill. Omnibus. That was passed into a law here. It's now an act, okay? Omnibus. What do we mean by omnibus? It means everything, all thrown into one pot, you might say. Omnibus is a typical Republican legislative tactic. It's been used before. And with an omnibus bill, you throw everything into that pot, including some goodies, as a way of getting forcing other people who may not like some of the negative features of the proposal, the act, to vote for it. Hold their nose and vote for it. Now, omnibus usually refers to what's called an appropriations bill. In other words, where you fund all the programs that you passed in previous laws and in the budget during the preceding session of Congress. You know, Congress will enact a law and so forth, but very conveniently, they don't fund it, and they propose a separate bill during the term to fund everything that they pass. That's called the appropriations bill. And usually the appropriations bill is kept separate from terms and conditions found in the content bills. But an omnibus bill means we're going to throw new proposals into the appropriations bill. So people are forced to, if they want the money for the bills and to keep the government running and so forth, they're forced to vote for things they otherwise would oppose. Okay, so the Republicans are doing this again. They did it frequently under George Bush and Ronald Reagan, when Reagan had Congress. And they're doing it again. And they're not even sworn in yet. You know what happened here in November, as we've talked about before, is the Republicans took over Congress. They deepened their control of the House of Representatives. I think they have like 60-vote majority there. And they swept 9 seats, as I had predicted earlier this fall, in the Senate. So they have like a 54-vote majority, 54-55, somewhere around there. Or they will have come January. They don't really have it yet. So how are they getting away with passing the legislation and using the tactics they like, even when they aren't sworn in? Well, that's because the Democrats are going along with them. The Democrats in the Senate have thrown in the towel. And what they're doing is cooperating fully with the Republican new legislative initiative, an offensive. By the way, take a look at my website or Telesur. I write regularly for Telesur, a South American media outlet now. And my piece of November 27th, where I reviewed the USA Republican Congress's new agenda. Go back, take a look at that, kind of predictions of where the Republicans are going to go. And you will see with this new omnibus bill and act, they're already going. They're not waiting until January, but they're able to go because the Democrats are giving them the green light. Well, why are the Democrats giving them the green light? Well, one of the excuses is, well, you know, we should negotiate with them now, and yes, this bill stinks, but boy, it'll stink more when the Republicans come in, so, you know, let's minimize the hurt. Well, that's, you know, just politicians double talk, because the Republicans will take what they got now and take even more when they come into full official power here in January. So it's really a lie, a misrepresentation that's being used on the Democrat side to say, well, we'll minimize the hurt here. It will be worse if we wait on some of these proposals. Well, that's your typical liberal attitude. Well, you know, let's concede, let's give up some concessions because things will even be worse if we don't give up the concessions. Well, then the employers take the concessions and come back and say, now we want more. Well, this has been going on, on the industry, the economic side for three decades now. Workers and unions have been given up concessions in the hope that that would satisfy employers. It only whets their appetite, and they come back and they want more. And we got a kind of political concession bargaining going on here, and our representatives, quote-unquote, are the Democratic Party. And in many cases, we didn't even vote for them. At least in the union, you get to vote for somebody. But here, can political concession bargaining going on now, so obvious with this omnibus bill, by people who we may not even have voted for. They're not even our representatives. Well, I don't consider these people representatives. They're just another wing of the same corporate party of America, the CPA. You know, Republicans, one wing, and Democrats, the other wing. And so, anyway, they cooperated here with this omnibus bill, and what we get, as I'll describe shortly, is a real harbinger of things to come. Okay. And by the way, other motivations for the Democrats. Obama, terrified that there would be another fight over a government shutdown, you know, because it's an appropriations bill, provides the funding. In fact, it's $1.1 trillion of funding. And Obama's terrified about that. Instead of standing up to the Republicans and saying, okay, you want to try to shut it down, you got blamed before. Okay, do it again, you know. Challenge the Republicans, stand up to them, but Mr. Jell-O, as I call him, doesn't stand up to anybody. Why is he Jell-O? Because, you know, if you get a dish of Jell-O and you put it on the table and you move the dish, it'll sort of sway back and forth. It'll look like it's moving, but it really goes nowhere. Well, that's Mr. Jell-O in the White House. Anyway, let's go on and talk about this omnibus bill. Well, first of all, over half of it is defense spending, well over half. Defense corporations are going to do quite well under this bill. By the way, I have a new article coming out on this, and I will have it posted on the PRN website, and it will be called Congress's First Salvo, the new Republican Congress's First Salvo. Corporations 5, workers minus 1. And so let's talk about the five big provisions in it that really benefit corporate America. And then we'll talk about the one provision, which amounts to a real rollback for workers in this country and a harbinger of worse to come. Okay. First, major freebie here for corporate America in this omnibus bill. Banking deregulation is back. Yes. And now it's being accelerated. You know, if you read the business press, you can see the beginning of the end here over the past year of attempts, feeble though they were, to regulate the banks and prevent them from gouging the rest of us and causing another financial crash as they did up to 2008-9, right? They've been at it again, of course. And in 2010, a bill was passed called the Dodd-Frank Act. Name of the Senator Dodd-Frank, or Barney Frank in the House, to try to regulate the banks, to prevent them from doing what they did before. Well, one of the elements of regulation was to prevent the banks from creating all these derivatives, as they're called, financial derivative products, which include a particular derivative called credit default swaps, which were very, very profitable for the banks, but were the key to building this house of cards, financial shaky edifice that had existed up to 2008 and still exists today to some extent. To prevent them, Dodd-Frank was to prevent them from building this derivatives, Potemkin Village, shaky edifice had existed. Well, how does that work? How do derivatives and credit default swaps represent a high-risk banking structure, and how does that impact the rest of us? Well, you know, banks like to sell all these fancy financial instruments, and they create them. You know, there's a traditional instrument called a mortgage, right? But then you create a bond out of mortgages. You string these mortgages together and you create a bond and you mark it up and you sell it to investors. I'm talking about wealthy folks, not you and I. We don't buy mortgage bonds. If you're really clever at a bank, what you do is take that mortgage bond and you chop it up and you throw it in five financial pots. And you throw some other chopped up financial celery and some other chopped up broccoli, financial broccoli, and you put it all in these different pots. Now you got five pots. You mix them all up, and you call it something else. And you put another 20% price hike on top of that, and you sell that. And then you keep doing that, and you're building this edifice of financial instruments that are created out of nothing. But you're selling it, and because the rich folks have so much money, they don't know what to do with it, they keep buying this stuff because they know as long as people keep buying it, the price is going to go up, and they can sell it when it goes up, and they can make a big capital gain. You know, this goes way back with capitalism. It goes way back to Holland. You know, you ever hear of the tulip crisis, the tulip boom? And the tulip bust, well, you know, back there in the 1600s, people were speculating with tulips, buying tulips, tulip bulbs. And everyone was buying it, and the price of tulip bulbs kept going up and up and up, and everyone kept throwing. It was the hot thing, and they bought all these tulips, and then the price collapsed. So we had the tulip bubble and the tulip bust, and they lost all that money. Folks invested in tulips. Well, you know, derivatives are kind of like modern-day tulips. As long as people keep buying them, it's okay. But at some point, when they stop buying them, then the price collapses. You see, as long as people buy them, the price keeps going up, and everyone keeps flipping them, like flipping houses, remember? And they make more and more money, and the price keeps going up, and suckers come in at the very end. And then, of course, it can't be sustained. At some point, the price comes down. And when it collapses, everyone tries to sell, which means the price falls even faster, and then you have big financial asset deflation. Well, all this stuff built up on top of the real asset called the house, in the case of the housing finance, are called derivatives. And one of them is called the CDS, credit default swap derivative. And what is that? Well, I just described how you create mortgage bonds, and then you know, you mix them up with something else, and you call that a collateralized debt obligation, and you mix those up to get a synthetic CDO, and you mix those up, you know, and throw in some asset-backed securities and some collateralized loan obligations and so forth, you know, make the salad bigger. And then, you know, it's pretty shaky, so you write a credit default swap on top of it, which means an insurance contract. In case it all goes bust, I'm going to make money. I'm going to create the bust, and I'm going to make money when it busts, you see? Capitalists are so clever. Right? So they've got all this CDSs, and Dodd-Frank 2010 Act was supposed to put a damper on this. It was supposed to say, okay, banks, you cannot use your banking unit, that part of your company, to create, buy, and sell derivatives if that banking unit also takes deposits from mom-and-pop savings and checking accounts. In other words, if you want to do that kind of a derivatives trading, it's got to be totally separate and off books. You know, another part of your company has to do derivative trading, and even some of you banks can't do derivatives trading directly. You can loan money to you know, shadow banks that would do the trading, and thus you get an interest payment on that, but you can't do it yourself directly and so forth. You know, Dodd-Frank was supposed to check the worst you know, excesses of this derivatives trading. Well, Dodd-Frank was created in 2010. Oh, but, you know, politicians knew exactly what they were doing. They created a Bank Bill Act in very general terms and said, okay, we're going to let the experts then define what we mean by this act, and we're going to give them 4 years to do it. 4 years. Oh, you know, a lobbyist's dream, isn't it? 4 years to come back and chip it away. They knew what they were doing when they gave a four-year implementation schedule for this thing. And, of course, the lobbyists have been chipping away at it ever since. And then over this past summer, 2014, time running out, what happened? Well, they got their way in the U.S. House of Representatives. U.S. House wrote its version of this bill. Actually, Citigroup representatives reportedly actually wrote the language for this, for the U.S. House. And the U.S. House of Representatives voted it up. In other words, they're going to let the banks continue derivatives trading. Voted it up without even a recorded vote. So Democrats and Republicans, you don't know who voted for this on the House side. Isn't that convenient? They knew it was a pretty dirty affair, so no one wanted to have their fingerprint on it. But they passed it. Passed it meaning Dodd-Frank Act is, you know, one of its teeth has been pulled with regard to banks doing derivatives trading. You know, before that, they already pulled, well, they didn't pull. Obama agreed to it. Obama agreed that, you know, all this discussion going on since 2010 regarding Dodd-Frank, Obama agreed that, well, look, non-bank companies, like manufacturing companies, who also invest in dividends can be totally exempt. I mean, derivatives can be totally exempt from derivatives trading limits. Now, let's get one thing clear. You know, when you talk about General Electric and some of these other big companies, they are like banks. You know, one-fourth to one-third of all the income they earn comes from financial investments. You know, this idea of a bank just is a bank and a non-bank is just a non-bank, in 21st century capitalism, the lines have really blended. So, in other words, they call that portfolio investments by non-bank companies, big ones. But they got exempted from the derivatives limit of a couple of years ago, I believe it was. And now, of course, the banks are exempted from it. In this bill, which modifies Dodd-Frank and allows banks to continue to trade in CDSs, credit default swaps, and derivatives. You know, there's other indications that have been growing, that bank deregulation is slowly creeping back in, or let's say the ending of feeble attempts to regulate the banks is creeping back in. If you look at the Securities Exchange Commission, they've been backing off, and the people who were trying to be aggressive in the SEC are leaving in droves. So the SEC is an attempt to enforce regulation. Has turned a quarter already. Also, there's a big issue brewing about the coziness of the New York Federal Reserve with the banking system, and that's still bubbling, right? There's all kinds of examples of back off here of deregulation, of re-regulation of the banks and deregulation, right? And there's another thing that people should be aware of that's in the background here, and that is Congress has decided, right, that the taxpayer isn't going to bail these banks out next time. Well, what happens? What's going to happen if they get in trouble? Which they will, unless you think history is going to stop. There will be another banking crisis, financial crisis, and well before the end of this decade, I have predicted. Well, how are they going to do it if the government isn't going to come in and bail them out, you know? How's it going to be done? Well, there's this thing called bail-ins. Depositors will have to help pay for the losses, take the losses. Depositors will take the losses, as well as shareholders and bondholders, if another bank like Lehman crashes, then it will. And the point is, allowing the banks to engage in derivatives trading, which is very lucrative income for them, that's why they've been pushing for this, is going to set the stage, perhaps, for another similar crisis. Okay, so the House did it without a recorded vote, and earlier in the year, and of course they passed the bill here, the omnibus bill, that contains that provision in it, exempting the banks. And the Senate votes 56-40 for this omnibus bill. Oh, 31 Democrats and 26 Republicans. Only 21 Democrats vote against this omnibus bill because of this derivatives exemption contained in this bill. Okay. So I can't blame the Republicans all by themselves. You know, this bill was passed with even more Democrats supporting it. Okay, so we see what this provision is, this very historic, risky provision of banking deregulation on the fast track again. What else is in this omnibus bill? More corporate tax cuts. Yes. Oh, you know, big insurance companies like Blue Cross Blue Shield, which under the Obamacare Health Act were supposed to start paying more taxes. Now they're exempt. You know, this omnibus bill exempts Blue Cross Blue Shield from the tax hikes that were scheduled under the ACA Obamacare Act. Another example where employers in the ACA side are exempted and given extensions and so on and so forth, many of these. Okay, and what else? There's $41 billion in the omnibus bill in tax extenders, as they called. And it was extending the tax cuts that were passed with the fiscal cliff here a couple years ago, preferential for business. Well, they're going to extend it again in 2014. And a lot of that $41 billion is direct tax cuts for big corporations that are making huge profits, huge profits. $18 billion of that $41 billion allows multinational corporations to continue to shield their offshore income, which is about $2 trillion that they're not paying taxes on, they're supposed to. It allows corporations in general to deduct from their taxes their business expenses. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could deduct our expenses from our tax bill? Well, businesses get to do it. And then the third big area is business research and development, which has been expanded by definitions recently, a couple of years ago, 2013, allowing R&D to be defined much more broadly as before, which means big tax cuts. It also falsely pumps up the size of the U.S. GDP, which I've mentioned before and we'll talk about again in coming weeks here. And talk again is very high on the agenda about a big change in the tax code, which means big corporate taxes, reduced corporate taxes from official tax rate of 35 to about 26-28%, and other tax cuts. I've been predicting this is coming for some time here. Maybe my prediction was a little premature, but I think now it's really on the agenda, and this tax code rewrite is something we're going to see. Because the Democrats in the Senate not only control the Senate, but they're willing to throw in the towel of those that are left on the whole tax code issue here. So we're going to see 2015 much more action on the tax code side. So that's a big benefit in the omnibus bill, right? Bank deregulation begins again in the bill. Corporate tax cuts starting to come again. Flood. Third, gutting the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. Yes, this is a favorite tactic of Republicans when they're in control of the House. They just, put a wall up against EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, by cutting its budget, and they cut it $60 million more. And the budget, by the way, is 21% below what it was 2010. It's been cut regularly, even under the Democrat control of Congress. Or Senate, at least. So EPA has been cut and being cut even more. Oh, but that's not all. In the Clean Water Act is being restricted here as well. Agribusiness is exempt now from polluting ponds and irrigation systems. The coal companies, limits on creating coal-fired power plants and methane emissions, that's been pulled. Methane, by the way, is 10 times more contributory to greenhouse gas emissions and global warming than is even CO2. So coal-fired companies are off the hook, at least as far as building plants outside the U.S. is concerned and contributing to global warming. And truck drivers. How do truck drivers come into this thing? Well, this is an environmental issue because people are part of the environment, right? Well, truck drivers, their previous limits on driving were 70 hours a week. That's been raised in this omnibus bill, and now employers can force truck drivers to drive 82 hours per week. That's 11 hours a day, 7 days a week. Okay, that's what that is. In other words, they can have these guys drive almost every day, 11 hours a day. Well, you know, I don't want to be behind one of those big rigs for a guy in his 81st hour a week. I don't know about you. It's a public safety thing, but when it comes to money, they don't care. Okay, so environmental issues and gutting the EPA benefit a lot of companies, particularly coal companies, agribusiness, right, and all these other 37 industries, as they're called, that the EPA tries desperately to regulate, and we're going to see a big change there. You know, the EPA has been attempting to do something about industrial plant emissions here for the last couple years and has been aggressively trying to move in that regard. Well, we'll see whether that even happens now with this new offensive against the EPA. Oh, fourth item. Benefit. Defense corporations. As I said, this is a $1.1 trillion bill. $554 billion of it goes to defense companies. Yeah, remember when they passed this fiscal cliff? You know, they exempted the defense companies here in 2013. Well, they're still exempt. And by the way, that doesn't even count the spending on Homeland Security, which defense companies really make a lot of money off of as well. Running at $50, $60 billion a year. They extended that only through January, and they're going to go at that again. So you're going to look at over $600 billion in direct defense spending continuing 60% or more, almost two-thirds of the $1.1 trillion goes to the defense buddies. $94 billion of that goes to equipment purchases. You know, F-35 fighters and submarines and stuff like that, avionics, Lockheed, Boeing, guys like that. They're continuing at the trough. Oh, and another $64 billion just for operations in Syria and against ISIS. $64 billion. And others, they're planning to ramp that up to an Afghanistan-like military theater. At the same time, the money spigot is opening up for the U.S. To provide military assistance, including lethal weapons, to its puppet government in the Ukraine. Reportedly, another $350 million to help assist the crashing Ukrainian economy. Okay, so, you know, defense companies are going to do real big. Corporations four. Number five, big gain. Money for the political parties. They're opening the elements of limitation on campaign spending by corporations. You know, the Supreme Court decisions 2010, Citizens United, and following McCutcheon here recently decision, that eliminated pretty much any limits on what individuals, wealthy individuals, could give to candidates and spend in campaigns on behalf of candidates, you know. But there was this last vestige of how much could be given to political parties. Well, that's been lifted now. You know, it used to be a limit of $97,000 a year. Now, with this omnibus bill, a nice provision for the two parties that passed it, which allows individuals to give $777,400 per year per two-party. Now, presumably, you could give it twice that to two parties, and double that in the cycle. So, in other words, the political parties, Republicans and Democrats, said, "Oh, well, gee, if they can give that much to individuals, well, why shouldn't they give that much to us?" And they lifted it. And reportedly, that was proposed by the Democrats, by Harry Reid. Democrats apparently have a big bill from the 2014 election, and they want to get it paid off, and they just, you know, lift the limits on campaign contributions. Okay, and what else here? So that's five big pro-business, pro-politician provisions. Now, and that's just the short list here in this 1,600-page omnibus bill, an appropriations bill full of writers benefiting corporations. The banks get big deregulation. Corporations get continued tax cuts. Businesses in general get the EPA sidelined. Defense companies can continue at the pigs at the trough. And the political parties get the okay to get money in exchange from all their big wealthy donors. Okay, what do workers get out of this? They get the other end of the stick. The worst provision, I mentioned about truck drivers, but the worst provision in the bill is multi-employer pension plans. Yeah, the beginning of the end for multi-employer pension plans. What are these? These are plans where unions negotiate defined benefit pensions, I mean real pensions, with these various employers, you know, in trucking, in restaurants, in retail, and, you know, different smaller, medium employers, where they require employers all to put so much money into the pension fund for the workers in these particular businesses and industries. You know, the major are trucking and retail and restaurants and hotels and so forth, right? Now, these are called multi-employer plans. Now, these are real pensions, defined benefit pensions, that are disappearing already. in which you are guaranteed for your rest of your life a pension payment from the pension fund based on how many years of service and what your wages and earnings were and so forth. You know, once you retire, you've got that guaranteed every month for the rest of your life. That's a real pension. You know, that's kind of like Social Security, right? Based upon what you earned when you retire, you get so much payment per month for the rest of your life. Of course, you know, the last three, four decades here, the attack on these pensions has come from what's called the 401k plans, where you put your money in, and maybe the employer matches 50%. He can, he doesn't have to, he can change, whatever, for the rest of, you know, your working period. And then whatever you got in your little 401k, you know, you live off of that. Well, that's not a real pension because, first of all, the investments in the 401k are usually in stocks and so forth. And if stocks go up and go down, you lose your money, right? And employers can put money in or not put money in. The big difference between a 401k and a defined benefit pension is the company is liable to pay you that pension, and the defined benefit pension for the rest of your life has to. And if that pension fund loses money, the employer's got to put the money back in. But a 401k, they don't. They wash their hands of all liability, and they say, okay, whatever you got is, you know, tough luck. If you don't got enough, if you only have $18,000 in your 401k, which is the average when you retire, and you spend it, you know, 1 year after that, try living off of Social Security at $1,100 a month, which is, you know, the average for Social Security benefit, you know. Go ahead. It's not surprising that the fastest growing part of the labor force are people who are over 65 returning to work because they can't afford not to. Okay, so that's the defined benefit and a 401k. Now, the multi-employer plan is a defined benefit plan. It's a real pension. But what's been happening is that employers have not been putting money that's required into the pension fund. When employers, go out of business or they no longer can afford to put money into the pension fund, the pension fund gets sort of transferred to this quasi-government agency called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which manages busted pension funds. And all employers that are involved with multi-employer plans have to pay a fee to this PBGC, which is then used if a particular pension fund goes bust or company goes bust, guarantees employees, workers, at least, you know, around half of what they would have gotten if the company didn't bail out or the fund didn't collapse. That's the PBGC. Well, what's happening is companies have been refusing to pay their fees to the PBGC. And as a result, the PBGC is sort of in deficit as well. Deficit has risen from $8 billion to $42 billion in the PBGC. Okay. The point is this has nothing to do with the level of benefits increasing. This is just employers not paying to this government agency, and the government agency says, gee, we can't cover the pensions that are going bust here on the private side in multi-employer plans. So what do you think Congress's response to this in the bill is? Instead of rescuing these plans, you know, we're talking about $42 billion, maybe $4 billion a year over 10 years. Remember, Congress bailed out one insurance company in 2008 to the tune of $180 billion. So now it can't bail out the PBGC, which covers a million workers whose pensions are, you know, transferred to the PBGC. By the way, there's about 10 million who are covered actively in multi-employer plans. So 10 million workers here. Instead of bailing out this fund with a loan, right, or the Federal Reserve could provide a zero-interest loan, After all, the Federal Reserve provided $14 trillion of zero interest to businesses since 2008. $14 trillion. You know, and Congress pays $180 billion just to AIG. You know, why won't they bail out a multi-employer pension plans and the PBGC? Well, what did they do instead? They gave a signal in the bill to employers who are making contributions into their pension funds and paying to the PBGC, right, that they can cut their contributions and cut their benefits. That's their answer. Even though these employer plans, multi-employer plans, you know, are estimated in general 15 to 20 years, there's enough money in the PBGC for another 15 years. Well, they're not waiting. They're saying, instead of helping out and giving loans to PBGC, whatever, or changing the law, they're saying, okay, let's get rid of the PBGC for multi-employer plans. Employers, let's get rid of multi-employer pensions. Start cutting. Now, this is really bad because it sets a precedent for other defined benefit pensions, which are single-employer plans, private defined benefit pensions, which there's 31 million more workers in, and state and local defined benefit pensions, millions more. And then there's 58 million people in Social Security, a kind of defined benefit plan. So this is a big signal, not only to employers and multi-employer plans, that we want to get rid of this. It's a big signal to the rest. Well, let's step up a new initiative to get rid of defined benefit pensions in this country, at the end of which is this big plum that they want to get rid of called Social Security. It's a very ominous development here, very ominous. All this represents political concession bargaining over wages, because that's all these pensions are. They're deferred wages. Workers give up a nominal wage increase in their wage pay, you know, while they're working, and to put money into a deferred plan, or have their employer, instead of giving them a wage increase, put money into the pension fund. Well, what you got now is, quote, political representatives, many of whom we don't even elect, who are sitting at the table in Congress here, making these decisions to reduce our future wages. You know, for years, we've been sitting around and employers have been reducing wages or not giving raises. Well, that's with regard to our current nominal wage. But now they want to go and take back what we already put into the pot. Now, if that's not austerity, American style, I don't know what is. Yes, it is. New forms of austerity, in other words, are being created right under our noses here. It's not just cutting benefits. Social programs and benefits, you know, austerity, and it's not just selling off government properties. That's, you know, part of austerity, traditional austerity programs. It's coming in new forms. I've been talking before about how it's coming in what's called labor market reforms in Europe. You know, particularly France and Italy are attempting to reduce wage increases in various ways by reforming labor markets. Okay, so let's look at government number two, Ukraine, right? Austerity in Ukraine. Well, you know, Ukraine bailed out, IMF, International Monetary Fund, attempted to bail out the Ukraine this last spring. You know, they gave Ukraine the $17.1 billion loan, in exchange for which Ukraine, the government, had to use the loan to pay the banks, Western European banks, for previous loans and repay the IMF, and part of that money had to be used by the Ukraine Central Bank to buy its currency, which didn't prove very successful. The currency continued to collapse, still does. And the Central Bank of Ukraine used that to give loans to import Ukrainian companies importing critical resources, semi-finished goods, whatever, to continue the economy. So very little left is left over to really stimulate the economy in the Ukraine. Well, the IMF strategy is, okay, the way you're going to generate money to do that in the Ukraine, it's not really going to come from the $17 billion loan. That's for repayments, for debt, you see. and for currencies and so forth. If you want to free up any money for investment, what you got to do, the IMF says, is you've got to cut the jobs, government jobs. You got to cut government wages. You got to cut subsidies, which are really going to start hitting the Ukraine here in January. Gas subsidies, and you got to cut pensions. And then you take that money and you give tax cuts to businesses. That's called restructuring, you see. Take money from the citizens, the average folks, and transfer it, and that's supposed to stimulate business and business investment and jobs and so forth, right? That's the whole IMF strategy here. But what's happening in the IMF and the Ukraine is something new. And that is, typically this IMF strategy is the IMF dictates what you're going to have to do, host country, whether you're Argentina in the past or Turkey or whatever, we're going to tell you this is the program, right? We're going to give you $17 billion. You've got to pay back us so much for previous loans. You've got to pay back the Western banks for previous loans. And then your central bank will get some of the money, and they can use it to buy up your currency because we've got to have a stable currency if we're going to restructure your economy, and then, we want to stimulate exports from Ukraine to get business going, et cetera. But it's usually, this is the program, folks. Get with it and show us that you're doing it. And the IMF periodically sends in these mission teams to see that the things are going on the way they've dictated. Well, that's been the traditional approach. But now, in the Ukraine, earlier this month, as the U.S. was passing the Omnibus Act, the Ukraine IMF says, oh, you guys aren't moving fast enough. The economy is crashing even faster. Our $17.1 billion isn't having much of an effect. And that's true. They had predicted, the IMF initially, a 4% drop in GDP this year. It's already over 8% and rising. And the currency is down 60-70%, a lot of financial instability growing there, no credit drying up, etc. So we got to front load this program, as they say, in a recent IMF press release. In other words, accelerate, intensify it. And to make sure that it happens, we're going to appoint our own Western bankers to run your economy. In other words, we're not going to just tell you what to do. We're going to appoint people to do it. This is new. And who did they appoint? Well, two very critical appointments were for Westerners. Westerners. In other words, the head of the finance minister of Ukraine now is a Western shadow banker called Natalia Jaresko. And the economics minister is a Lithuanian with deep connections to Swedish and German shadow banks, named Iveris Abramovicius, right? Oh, these are two foreign citizens. They aren't even citizens of the Ukraine, and they're being given the job of implementing the IMF plan. That's what's new here. Who is Natalia Jaresko? Well, Natalia Jaresko is a shadow banker. She's the head of the private equity fund called Horizon Capital and has been running another fund created under the Clinton years called the Western NIS Enterprise Fund. This is a fund that Clinton created. He created a whole bunch of them for Eastern Europe as the Soviet Union collapsed and the U.S. made an economic foray into Eastern Europe here. It created a number of funds, a Polish fund, a Baltic fund, and this was a fund for the Ukraine and Moldova. And the U.S. put $150 million into this fund. And Bill Clinton appointed certain directors to this fund from the private banking sector, and she was one of them. Natalia was one of them. He appointed her as the director. Now, Natalia was an employee of the U.S. State Department at the time of her appointment. Yes, she was chief of economic section for the U.S. Embassy in the Ukraine. So she gets appointed to this Western NIS Enterprise Fund. And once she's appointed, she and others create Horizon Capital Private Equity Fund, and the WNISF gets funded by the U.S. And you know, the shadow private structure here to WNISAF, Western, let's just call it Western Fund, is the Horizon Capital private equity firm. You know, what do private equity firms do? They go around and they identify good investment opportunities for the shareholders, and then they buy up these companies or buy a controlling interest in these companies. And when the company's stock goes up, they sell them, or when you know, the company expands, they sell them off. You know, it's buy and break up, buy and break up. And all their investors, you know, do quite well in the process. And you know, Horizon Capital has created a couple other funds as well since 2005, with the partial Western Revolution and takeover called the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. And if you look at who's going to benefit from this, well, you know, Natalia Jiresko is now the finance minister. Natalia is the CEO for Horizon Capital and the Western Fund. You know, Ukrainian law said, well, you know, we can't have foreigners who are members of the cabinet and the government. Well, what did President Poroshenko do? He exempted her. He gave her 2 years to become a Ukrainian citizen. Well, actually, he appointed her as a citizen. Excuse me, I got it wrong. Now, you can't have dual citizenship in the Ukraine, so she's got 2 years to renounce her U.S. citizenship. But, you know, don't hold your breath on that. They'll find another way out of that, too. And this guy, Avaras Abramovicius, you know, is the Western hedge fund shadow banker plant there on the economics ministry. You know, the finance ministry, Jiresko and Abramovicius and the economic ministry, these are the two foreign appointees of the IMF and the U.S. and the Europeans, the EU here, to run the show. And I'm sure in the process, you know, the Horizon Capital in the background will be active with Jiresko in the front ground, and then they will funnel a lot of business through Horizon to Western Western investors and shareholders, finance capitalists. If you look at Horizon Capital, who in Horizon Capital are the directors? Horizon Capital is this private equity fund set up out of Chicago, Chicago interests. Oh, Chicago, I think that's where, what's his name, Obama comes from, right? Chicago connection. You know, the folks that put Obama in office funded him. You know, the Pritzkers and so forth funded his campaign, put him in office, Chicago business mafia. You know, Horizon is really located in Chicago. And who are the big shareholders here? If you look at Horizon, oh, Patrick Arbor, longtime connections with Chicago banks, commodity producers, options, futures, trading, Chicago Board of Trade, all that. Oh, agribusiness, commodities. Whitney McMillan, who's he? Oh, also ex-Cargill senior I think he was CEO, right? And who else? Robert Cotton, Richard Arthur. Oh, connected to defense companies, Hughes Electronics, Lockheed Martin, Naval Submarine Electronics Divisions. Jeffrey Neal, long co-founder of Horizon, longtime CEO with Global Investment Banks, Merrill Lynch. Mark Iwaszko, co-founder of Horizon, and also with Jiresko of this other fund called the EGGF Fund, with extensive holdings and connections in mortgage banking and industrial manufacturing, chairman of the current Ukraine real estate firm, Dragon Ukraine Properties, PLC. Oh, look at all the financial connections here, right? Behind Horizon Capital, which is sitting behind now Natalia Jiresko, which is running the economics ministry in the Ukraine. Ha! Well, that's how the capitalists penetrate, using the IMF as a battering ram to really get their claws into the host country. And what they're going to do is funnel investments and money and take over the best. And, you know, if you look at the background, these Horizon Capital directors, these are kind of the industries that are most promising in the Ukraine. Ukraine has a large history of shipbuilding, advanced shipbuilding in the Ukraine. Okay, agribusiness, big in Western Ukraine. Certain industries, you know, very strong in the Ukraine. Ukraine's not a backward country. Ukraine has a lot of advanced industries. It's been sort of picked apart and for 20 years now since the breakup of the Soviet Union and exploited both by Western oligarchs and Russian oligarchs. You know, they've been taking turns for 20 years ripping off the Ukraine. Ukraine, the folks once had one of the highest standards of living under the old Soviet Union. Today it's one of the lowest, 20 years of depression, and that's where they are now. Okay, so that's the Ukraine. In other words, more what we've got coming here, front-loading of the IMF agreement, more intensification in cutbacks that are going to occur here with the Ukraine austerity program. We're going to accelerate, IMF is going to accelerate it, and Jurescu and the others are going to funnel all the benefits to their friends through Horizon Capital. That doesn't even need to do the investment. They'll just take a fee setting up the Ukrainian companies with all these U.S. capitalists who are circling around. I'm sure Vulture is going to make a big, big killing here in the Ukraine. Okay, and what's the third government? Third government is Japan. Abenomics, right? Shinzo Abe, the new, he's not new, he got reelected, even though he created another recession, the fourth in 6 years this year, in Japan, he got reelected. And what's coming in Japan is what's called his third arrow. When he was first elected in 2012, the first arrow was trillions and trillions of dollars of central bank liquidity injections, just like the Federal Reserve. Whoa, that caused the stock markets and everything to rise 70-100%, and all the investors in Japan made a killing as a result of that. But, of course, you have huge deficits in debt in Japan for 20 years going on doing this, you know, taking care of investors but not the rest. What's his second arrow here after 2012? That was to raise sales taxes, and he raised them to 8%, and that collapsed the economy here this year because folks like in the U.S. don't have a lot of money, real money to spend except on debt and borrowing. So it collapsed the economy, fourth recession in 6 years. That was arrow two, the sales tax increase, on top of the free money, trillions given to investors. Now the third arrow here was supposed to be restructuring and labor market reforms. Restructuring labor market reforms sounds just like Europe. Labor market reforms and restructuring. That's the new form of austerity in Europe, and it's the new form here coming in Japan. So what they're going to do is start making it more difficult for workers and unions to get wage increases. Oh, he talks about raising wages to Japanese companies who are sitting on $2.65 trillion of excess cash, and they're not sharing it with their employees, just like the U.S. It's no different from the U.S. Same thing going on in Japan. Japan's very much like the U.S., a mirror image politically and economically. You know, they're doing the same thing. They're sitting on all this cash, not giving raises to anybody, so they can't spend except by borrowing. So the answer there is labor market reform, just like in Italy and France. That's what they're talking about, which is really a code word for let's have more wage compression, right? There's a way of making businesses more profitable. And the idea is if they're profitable, they'll invest. They're not. They're sitting on $2.6 trillion. This is in the U.S. All this monetary policy, free liquidity is making them rich, and they're sitting on it. They're hoarding it. And that's one of the big problems of 21st century capitalism here. So we got labor market reforms. Another example of austerity in Japan. We got intensified austerity through IMF in Ukraine. And we got our omnibus bill. Whoa, austerity is live and kicking. Okay, that's going to do it for today. And next week, come back, we're going to talk about China chasing its shadow banks. Or China chasing its shadows, whatever you prefer. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.